you're not a business unless you have people that are going to help you build that business. And so I agree with you. I think you have to make the investment. You have to intentionally make it a priority. And I don't think you have to have really deep pockets or tons of money to roll out great programs. Roll out programs that are meaningful for our employees, that matter to them. And it didn't cost a lot of money to be able to do that.
Constraints drive innovation. Hey everyone, it's Matt here for another episode of Thinking Inside the Box, a show where we discuss complex issues related to work and culture. If you're interested in checking out our other content, you can find us at bentohr.com and wherever you find your favorite podcasts by searching Thinking Inside the Box. Consider leaving us a 5-star rating, a comment, and subscribing. It ensures you get updated whenever we release new content and really helps amplify our message. In today's episode, I chat with Heidi Halver, the Ottawa, Canada-based Chief People Officer of Tractic, where she's leading a world-class team building the world's largest security workforce management company. I've known Heidi for a few years now. We originally met as part of the Grow HR Mastermind program presented by Hacking HR, where she quickly differentiated herself as an innovative and strategic people leader. With a focus on transformational HR, Heidi has built 3 corporate HR departments from the ground up, along the way earning a host of awards and recognition, including a Leadership Agency Award for Woman of Distinction, in 2017, a Top 25 HR Professional Award, and a Top 40 Under 40 Award. And together we covered a lot of ground, beginning with her experiences as a business executive supporting startups, alongside human resources considerations for venture-backed organizations. Though we eventually landed on the topic of this podcast, growth mindset and how it affects mid-career executive professionals, a topic I know well. And we discussed how education and professional credentials along the way are essential ingredients, along with lived experiences, in developing the next era of business leaders. And in today's rapidly changing job market, it's becoming increasingly important for leaders to consider resilience in their career planning. According to the Harvard Business Review, today the average tenure of a leader is just 5 years. And a Deloitte survey found that 85% of business executives believe that their industry is facing significant disruption in the next 3 years. So the question asks, how are you mitigating the risk? And it's one that I posed to Heidi, along with answering myself in what was a really cool conversation. And I know you'll want to hear the full story. I, again, had an amazing time, great conversation, and I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did recording it. And now I bring you Heidi Halver. We met Heidi Halver during Grow. That was what we talked about. And I agree, we've always had a really cool connection. You know, individuals that are growth oriented, spent the majority of their careers in human resources, and now find ourselves at various inflection points in our professional careers. And I think it's going to be a really cool conversation. Thanks for joining today.
Thanks for having me.
Before we get started, I want to start this conversation like I do all of them, which is to help our audience get to know a bit more about the guest. So Heidi, what are your background, your experiences, and what led you to today?
So I'm a people leader. I've been in HR for over 25 years, and I actually am based in Ottawa, Canada's capital. I didn't live here my whole life. I actually grew up in the Eastern Townships in Quebec, in Coensville, a beautiful spot in Quebec that I highly recommend your listeners take a visit to at some point. Lots of great culture there. I moved to Ottawa because I was an Anglophone who spoke a little bit of French, and I knew in Ottawa that might give me a little bit of an edge at the very start of my career. And I started my career as an executive level assistant. And, you know, I always make a joke that if I was prime minister, I would have everybody do a role like customer success, customer service, retail, you know, serving the general public. I think it's something that builds character. I also think it is brings an appreciation that you don't have if you don't do that work. I love what they're doing now with volunteering in the high schools and having everybody log hours. I think that's amazing. And I hope that program continues. We didn't have that opportunity growing up. And I think it would have really been a game changer for me, especially when I started volunteering when I moved to the city. Different podcasts for a different day, and how that's kind of changed me. I've had a great career. I've been in school, which feels like forever. I think, you know, I put myself through school starting back when I moved to the city of Ottawa, and I was an administrative assistant taking my first HR course, you know, and then I practiced as I continued to grow from an academic perspective. And I think that helped differentiate me because both from a classmate and also a team member, I was able to bring my studies into my day job, and I was able to bring, you know, my work experiences into the classroom. And things just resonated with me differently than some of maybe the first or second year students. As an immature student, I brought that lived experiences to the classroom, into my assignments, and it was an amazing experience. And I think that I wouldn't have done it any differently.
Where does your quest for education come from? Because you obviously acquired a lot of practical experience and then decide to make the shift into education. Where did that desire for you stem from?
So in my family, I'm first generation university grad for, you know, my immediate family. And that wasn't necessarily something I always envisioned for myself, partly because I didn't have, you know, when you look at, I looked around, my family weren't university grads. When I, you know, started kind of, you know, I started at the college level and then realized that as I wanted to kind of grow out my HR career, I remember early days, and I still give this advice and counsel to people, you know, go and look for that dream role. And I did. I remember looking, I want to be a VP, you know, of HR. I want to be a chief human resources officer. We didn't use chief people officer at the time. And I would look at the job descriptions, Matt, and I would see what are the experience that, you know, these professionals need to have? What are the credentials that they need to have? And that guided me. I created a bit of a pathway, a plan, and it started with getting my, you know, my certification. And then I realized I didn't want a roadblock one day for me to experience is when I was, you know, wanting to apply for my dream role and a degree requirement, you know, set me back. So I pursued my degree online. And I mean, I was a director of HR when I graduated with my degree in HR. I was also the same year I won a 40 under 40 recognition. And not a lot of people realized that I didn't have my degree because I was a director. I was practicing, right? I was leading a global team. And it didn't stop there. You know, I literally last December, a year ago, finished my last certification. And it was in diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging, an area I'm really passionate about. And I felt as an HR leader, an area that we any leader really needs to lean in and learn and be opening. I wanted more lessons and learning. I wanted to be more comfortable in that space. It's ever evolving. And it was something, a journey that I really enjoyed. I got a lot from it, both personally and professionally.
Along the way, you made stops in a number of organizations. And where we first connected was part of a program presented by Hacking HR called Grow. And it came as a result just before the pandemic actually started in 2020, where we said, hey, Enrique Rubio and I, the founder of Hacking HR, got together and said, we'd love to create a group where HR leaders can come together, connect, share, learn, and ultimately, no pun intended, grow from each other. Yeah. And that was where we first interacted. At the time, you were heading up HR for an organization called Invest Ottawa, a venture-backed organization that was supporting startups within the Ottawa geography. For those who aren't familiar, Ottawa is Canada's capital, so there's a significant public service population here. There's also a growing tech segment outside of Ottawa that is obviously seeing significant growth over the last 5 to 7 years. I'm curious for you what that experience taught you and what you were able to take away from your time at Invest Ottawa.
So GrowX, I was in the inaugural class, and I weaseled my way into that. I don't know if you know that, but I think Enrique said it's full. And I was like, Enrique, let's explore this. You know, can you get me? And I got myself in, and it was an incredible experience engaging with leaders across the globe. It was amazing. Invest Ottawa is actually a nonprofit, not-for-profit that gets funding from various levels of government. But you're right, where the companies we support are venture-backed, and they're from you know, at different stages in their growth. Not all of them are. Some are still bootstrapped, of course. But they are organizations that are primarily technology-focused. You know, that two-person founder with the idea to change the world in a new, innovative way, to those companies looking to scale to 100 million in revenue. And so when I joined Invest Ottawa, it was such a unique opportunity. I had been supporting the organization first as a growth coach and then supporting the organization as a consultant at the time. And I was looking to make my way back to the private sector in an in-house leadership role. And the executive team, Michael Tremblay, I'm a huge fan of, he and his leadership team asked if I would consider coming in to help build out the talent strategy for the city of Ottawa. Most talent go to Montreal, Toronto, and Vancouver, MTB, when they're relocating into this amazing country. And we were trying to put Ottawa on the map. And, you know, we subsequently built out a team of almost 16 people over my tenure, building incredible programming to help our companies basically build out their talent profile, their talent communities, right? Helping to attract talent and a big push to retain the talent we have in our city. We have amazing universities in this city. We have a lot of international talent that come and do their education here. We wanted to keep them here. And that meant building more companies that would provide them the growth opportunities they were looking for. We also were big on building out alumni programs to welcome people who had left Ottawa, bringing them back to the region. The original program shifted during the pandemic. I remember having a call with our director of talent strategy when we realized, you know, the original program that we've built, we need to shift so that we can retain the talent. And I remember as some of our early companies started to downsize, we quickly pivoted the program to enable to make connections to other companies that were still growing in those early days when those first layoffs started to happen. And I'm really proud of the work we've accomplished during my tenure there. We had an incredible team. We did a lot of reskilling programming as well to help, fuel more talent, to help fuel the economy in the city. And during that tenure though, Matt, you know, I always had the opportunity to be the growth coach for our accelerator, our startup program, and our scale-ups. And so I got to work with some of Ottawa's top companies, work with some of our best CEOs and help advise and coach and just be the friend of executive teams and HR leaders in the city. It was an exciting role. You know, I had two HR peer groups that I hosted and did biweekly calls with a lot of the HR leaders in the city to just, again, be that sounding board, help them to, you know, thrive in their workplace and, you know, be the best that they could be. And it's nice to have somebody in your corner, right, who can share lived experiences. And so that was a great role. And I learned a lot from my team at Invest Ottawa and from obviously all the exposure to the companies that I had a chance to support and getting to work with all the leaders. You know, you take away, as you know, as you've experienced yourself, from every engagement. And I always feel that's funny. Sometimes when you're helping someone, you think, I'm getting so much out of this. I almost feel, you almost feel bad about it because you want to make sure you're giving as much as you're getting. So I think that learning has been fundamental in my career so far.
When I think about organizations that are in early stage or are venture backed, I think about the tension that exists, frankly, in every organization, but it might be more exaggerated in earlier stages around what has traditionally been a binary conversation: people, profit. And those two levers have to be balanced, have to be pulled. When you're growing and scaling your organization, you clearly need to have some degree of financial success. But I think we both would agree that success does not come without having really great, committed people. As you worked with HR teams and organizations in that capacity, how did you help them find that balance between working with a strong financial statement and strong financial health, but also looking at the talent mandate necessary for them to grow and have success in the future?
It's such an important question. And it's not something we explore as, you know, as we're, you know, growing to become HR leaders, the importance of balancing the interests of the business and the team. I think a lot of folks that I've encountered over the years tend to lean one way or the other. And I think it is, in this case, a really nice harmony and balance. And I think that, you know, the pandemic has stretched us as especially in the HR field, I think in a good way. It's enabled us to be innovative, forced us sometimes to be more innovative. I don't think it's, you know, I've never had a big budget, Matt, anywhere I've gone. I've always had to be really creative and sort of hack it out. I started building momentum and people started seeing, you know, what we were doing and seeing the progress and then being able to then kind of go to the well and get more money to fuel kind of whatever it is that we were doing. But I like that. I love that challenge. And again, I think I've learned over the years that, you know, I am a brainstormer. I have great ideas, but it means nothing unless it's meeting the needs of the team. So I take a very kind of unified approach where I bring the team along on the journey. I ensure they're part of our solution so that I'm not, you know, and my team is not necessarily coming up with great ideas and just rolling them out and hoping for the best. Hope is not a strategy, but bringing four team members who are interested in what we're doing, getting their buy-in, their insight along the way, getting them to be the ambassadors of the programs that we're rolling out. And I think that, you know, a lot of companies will often say, and a lot of companies I engage would often say, we don't have money for that program. We don't have the capacity to roll this out. We don't have the time. And, you know, you're not a business unless you have people that are going to help you build that business. And so I agree with you. I think you have to make the investment. You have to intentionally make it a priority. And I don't think you have to have really deep pockets or tons of money to roll out great programs. You and I are both examples of being able to roll out programs that are meaningful for our employees, that matter to them. And it didn't cost a lot of money to be able to do that.
Well, I think that's well said. And I also think it's worth restating that you don't need to choose. It doesn't have to be a binary question. And that one thing you and I inevitably realized in our work is that investments made in people ultimately benefit the organization's finances. And therefore, we felt confident in our ability to establish pilots or small experiments and tests, knowing that we would build momentum and attract additional resources to those investments going forward. I remember my first foray into people analytics. You know, I worked for a large multinational, $21 billion company annually, 96,000 associates in Canada. And I was tasked with overseeing a people analytics practice that had upwards of 300 unique measures that we tracked. What we did with it, maybe not as effective as it could have been. That's a story for a different day. But when I joined my next organization, took on more of a senior HR role, I was tasked with establishing for the first time a people analytics practice. And I remember my very first investment was going on to Upwork, identifying data scientists that were university students to help me build a very rudimentary predictive analytics model to address regrettable attrition. In an organization that prior to me doing that had two HR measures, wage cost and turnover. And we did a survey every 3 years. So we had a survey result that was 2+ years old. And when I made the case to the board and to the senior team, it was around the idea of, let's not play KPI whack-a-mole. Let's focus on fire prevention, not firefighting. It's cheaper. It's less disruptive. It's better for the organization financially. But I definitely got some people who looked at me and said, what is HR doing in the data realm? Why aren't you building more recognition programs and other types of, you know, traditional HR elements? And as I expressed the importance of connecting people's performance and sentiment and satisfaction and commitment to the business results, it became clear to the organization, wow, this actually made sense. Mm-hmm. That modest investment up front, which I funded out of my kind of discretionary budget, soon attracted more funding from the organization. And pretty soon the CFO of the company wanted to take over analytics for the entire organization, realizing the impact that it was having, not only within HR, but also in the broader organization. Once we were able to connect people analytics to operational KPIs, to financial KPIs, and all those various things. And for individuals that are in an organization right now that are struggling with maybe I'll call it old school thinking or struggling to make progress or to have success, understand that for all of us, even folks as accomplished as yourself, Heidi, we have to start somewhere and we have to prove our business case and we have to prove the impact that we can have. People aren't just in today's reality going to hand you $50,000 or $100,000 for a trial. Those days are gone. Now is a business case. There's KPIs that are tracked. There's an ROI that needs to be delivered, or you don't get future investment. And frankly, the impact of credibility in some cases could be material enough that you probably wouldn't suggest something innovative for quite some time if your project failed. So I think for the folks that are establishing that practice to understand that starting out small, there's nothing wrong with that. Mm-hmm. Keep the expectations low, learn when the environment is relatively safe, and evolve it over time to a place where the maturity tells a better story. At that point, people don't remember all the things in the early days. They remember the most recent impact. And the moment we were able to take that program and graduate it outside of HR into the broader business, that's when I knew we had success. Yeah. That's when I knew we were going to have success with analytics. And ultimately, the organization benefited from that and still benefits from that to this day as they think through their business operations.
Hey everyone, it's Matt here. I hope you're enjoying today's discussion. And before we continue, I wanted to make you aware of my latest creative project, This Week at Work. Presented in partnership with my good friend, Chris Rainey of HR Leaders, each Friday we'll live stream on LinkedIn at 7 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. That's 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time and 3 p.m. GMT for our European viewers. And together bring you the latest trends, news on topics emanating from organizations, everything from culture to technology and the future of work. Joining is easy. Just follow me on LinkedIn, click the bell at the top right-hand side of my profile, and you'll get notified when we go live each week. And whether you do experience the content live or later, if you've been following me for a while, you'll no doubt recognize the fun banter Chris and I have developed over the years. And whether it's been podcasts or digital events, we're so excited to again bring you the topics affecting today's workplaces and their leaders. And now, back to our discussion.
You know, the last two, three organizations that I've joined, within the first week, the first thing I'm doing is presenting a dashboard. What data do we have? What data are we missing, right? Where do I want to prioritize whatever money I do have to go and enable us to have the right tools to get the right amount of information to make the right decisions? And so, you know, funny enough, I resonate with your story because I hired a co-op student in one of my roles to build out a proprietary turnover calculator because, you know, in technology in the sector that I'm in, you know, there's always a debate about the cost and, you know, it can go up to upwards to $100,000 or more, depending on time to hire and orientation, onboarding, time to productivity, costs for recruitment. And there was a kind of a debate. And because we're a data company and we hired a data analytics student to come in and build our own proprietary tool, it was brilliant because we were able to then shed the insights, which I think is one of my superpowers, taking the data and go, I feel this way because this data says this, and let me give you the qualitative pieces of information that you don't see here. And I think that, you know, one of the things that can differentiate any leader, as you said, is, you know, looking to what's important to the business. What data do you have available to you to help you make sound business decisions to, you know, balance the interests of the business and the team? And then, you know, again, starting anywhere, you know, a lot of times people look at headcount, turnover, employee satisfaction. Those are all amazing. I always challenge leaders to go, well, what next? You know, what else are you going to do with that information? Interesting that your turnover says this. What puzzles, what trends and patterns are you seeing? Right through, you know, your exit interviews, through the hiring teams that were associated with some of that turnover, the fact that maybe the turnover is happening within a certain time period of tenure or a certain geographic location, remote versus in person, all of those things. And I think a lot of times people are just looking at voluntary and involuntary, and that's where they stop. And I say, go 2, 3, 4 layers deeper. I think it's a missed opportunity otherwise.
The original impetus for this conversation was a conversation that we had offline. We recently were at an event that you hosted, Informed HR out of Ottawa. And in your opening keynote, you talked a lot about transition and about inflection points. And that led to a conversation offline around your own career inflection point. And myself, having gone through one recently, we kind of were able to connect on that basis. You know, I'm curious for you. You know, you're at a stage now in your career where, as you mentioned, you've had a lot of success. You've had a number of roles where you've been, you know, the VP or head of HR. You've pursued an educational and certification type experience as well to supplement that. Now that you look at your career where it is and look at the next chapter, what are some of the things that you're thinking about? What are some of the questions you're asking yourself? What are some of the motivators that you're considering at this stage of your career that maybe you didn't consider when you got that top 40 under 40 list when you started things out?
Yeah, great question. Team is number one for sure. You know, how can I add value to a team? How can I, you know, am I going to learn from this team? Am I going to grow? Am I going to stretch myself? I think that, you know, whenever I explore a role, I think of those things like, you know, who am I going to be spending, you know, 8 hours a day with? Am I going to be able to contribute to them? Are they going to contribute to me? I think that's huge for me. And I paid maybe not, I've been very fortunate, thankfully, but it wasn't something I intentionally went looking for. I think the opportunity to make an impact is huge. You know, what is the company doing what is the runway in front of them? What does that look like? You know, how can I help create more economic growth to create more jobs? That's something that I'm really mindful of at this stage in my career. And I also think about, you know, the experience. Like, I want a great employee experience. I want a great team member experience as well. I give back to our community a lot. That's something that is really important to me. I think it's helped, you know, fuel some of my growth up until this point. And I want a role that empowers, like that enables me to channel that experience into my role, into my day-to-day, but also appreciates that this is important to me and enables me to have that flexibility, you know, to attend board meetings and committee meetings and so forth, and lean into organizations that make an impact in our community. That is something that's really important to me. And I need to make time for that. And I want a role that enables me to do that. And I've been very fortunate that the roles that I have had and the executive teams I have been part of have embraced that 100%. And I think it's actually a way I differentiate myself. I would say too, you know, the impact that I can have on the next generation. That is something that I look for, you know, being able to build a team and or nurture and help grow a team of that next generation. In my case of HR leaders, that's something that that I get really excited about, that inspires me. And again, you know, just general growth, you know, am I going to be accepting a role that I'm going to be stretching myself as well, doing something new? You know, what am I going to be learning? How am I going to reflect my time in this organization and walk away at some point potentially, you know, to another organization and go, wow, I'm really proud of what we've accomplished together. I am big on, I'm part of the great reimagination camp, not the great, you know, resignation. I think the pandemic has, you know, enabled individuals to reflect on what they are looking for in their lives. And it was a point in time where I think it was, you know, forced upon a lot of us that we had to stop, reflect, you know, and say, where are we going to choose to use, how are we going to choose to use our time? Where are we going to choose to, you know, spend our time, you know, supporting an organization, et cetera. And I think it's an exciting time actually for individuals to kind of take that time to go, you know what, we've just gone through, we're still going through a global pandemic, change our world as we know it. I think there are a lot of good, even though there's been a lot of bad and loss. And I mean, I don't want to take any of that away. But I do think that we need to look at what good came from this. And I think for a lot of people, they are doing that reflection on, you know, what's next for them. How do they want to spend their time? People have been leaving roles that they weren't happy in for a long, long time, that were making them unhealthy and unwell, and are following their passion projects, yourself included. And I think, you know, would we all have been having these same thoughts and feelings? Maybe, but I'm not sure we would have, a lot of the folks making transitions right now would have actioned these things. And I celebrate that. I do. I think it's a really interesting time. And I hope that people don't lose sight of what matters to them. And they do continue to take that reflection, even as the world is, you know, trying to get back to a new normal.
Yeah, I think that's well said. I also think the term great reimagination, I think, is a good way to talk about it. You and I have discussed offline the great resignation. I think you're right. There was a lot of latent dissatisfaction or disengagement. There was also a broader acceptance of this is just the way things are. Whether it was, you know, I don't know how many times I've heard the term work-life balance and rolled my eyes. It just, it didn't exist in a pre-pandemic world. At least it didn't for me and didn't for the majority of leaders I spoke with. It was an illusion that we talked about, where work-life balance was this aspirational target we were all hoping to achieve. And the reality is it's not balanced if work always takes precedent. That's not balance. And as we've moved forward, I agree with you. We were in a lot of ways forced to make fundamental shifts in terms of where the work was done, how we structure the work, what the renewed role of leadership and how important that is going forward, and how that needs to evolve in a world that's becoming increasingly hybrid, where technology is becoming a dominant interface between people, whereas traditionally, and at least in our profession, there was always a strong bias towards, let's get everyone together in the same room. Let's bring humans in the same place. And I get that. I appreciate that. Yeah. For an organization, for a function that also really pushed principles of diversity, equity, inclusion, and belonging, I always felt that was a little bit disingenuous when I knew the barriers that existed for some folks to participate in person, whether it was a consequence of physical disability or financial, you know, inability or proximity because of locations of where they're working, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. If you've ever been the only person in a meeting on a conference call when everyone else is in the room, like that's a whole different level of torture that I don't know that anybody wants to experience ever again. And at the same time, I've been speaking with organizations and asking them about where they are. And I think the general arc, as I've seen it, is 2020, it was reaction oriented. It was about business continuity. It was about survival. Organizations made the shift. Here's a laptop. Here's a VPN. Here's a cell phone. Work starts tomorrow at 8:30 in the morning. Get after it. And eventually we're going to all come back together in the office.
And do your best while you're teaching your children at Correct. Home remotely, caring for your ones and trying to navigate through one of the scariest times of all of our lives, right? I mean,
big unknown. And at a time when we're trying to navigate those challenging situations, to your point, everyone is taking on more stressors, whether it's caring for children, caring for parents, caring for friends, caring for yourself. There was additional complexities. There was also some significant environmental and economic impacts. People lost jobs. Businesses went under. It was a significantly challenging period of time. As things matured and we got into this new normal, as it were, it became commonplace for folks to work from home a portion of the time, to work from the office a portion of the time. In some organizations, that was more exaggerated than others. But there was still this lingering belief of when things go back to normal, we'll take these lessons with us and we'll go back to the way things were always were done, because for a lot of folks, that's how it worked really, really well. We're now at a stage, we're in 3 years into this pandemic, and for many organizations, the behaviors are ingrained, the expectations for employees have been reset, and we see organizations struggling with the transition back into a different type of format as public health regulations are relaxed. And we're seeing almost every other day a tech company announce people come back to the office. I mean, last week it was Snap is telling their employees to come back to the office 4 days a week. 2 weeks before that, it was Twitter with Elon Musk's purchase telling everyone to work hardcore and get back into the office. Before that, it was Meta who announced the loss of 11,000 workers at a time when they made billions of dollars and the need for people to come back to the office. I think it was 3 days a week. I might be wrong in that regard. And to me, it's an interesting period, perhaps even more interesting than 2020, in that now we don't have a macroeconomic, we don't have a global pandemic that's really pushing us one way or the other. Now it comes down to how do businesses and their leaders really want to lead and operate? And that presents a unique challenge for professionals who are trying to determine what they value going forward. As you look at this period of time in your life, I'm curious, what has shifted for you? So what things are more important today than they may have been 3 years from now, 3 years from before? And what are you seeing when you're talking to other folks that are in similar positions?
Well, I think I agree with you. I think remote roles enable a much more welcoming, inclusive culture. It also opens up your talent pools immensely. I, even from a professional perspective, as you know, I think of career growth and you know, what I want to kind of achieve and who I could potentially work for. I'm no longer limited to working in the city where I reside. And I think that's a huge opportunity for individuals to flourish, to truly thrive and create great opportunities and make an impact beyond kind of their kind of borders, if I could say that. I think it's a missed opportunity for organizations if they're losing sight as what matters. I think more organizations need to, you know, I feel like people are going through that identity crisis. I think they're hopeful that we can return to what was. I'm not sure that's the case. As you said, employees have reset their expectations. They've become very comfortable with the idea of finding maybe a little bit more, we call it in our house, work-life harmony by having that flexibility. People don't want to give that up, nor should they have to give that up to do the quality of work, you know, to doing great work. When they are at their best, and that might be early morning, later in the evening. I recognize, again, our privilege of being in roles that enable us to work remotely from home. Not everyone has that opportunity. And I celebrate all of those individuals who have to be in the office every day and don't have that same opportunity to work remotely. it's been something I never thought in my career I would want to work remotely or enjoy. I was at the office every day, all day, even sometimes when I shouldn't have been, right? I too went to work when I was under the weather. I think that's one good thing about the pandemic. People have stopped doing that, thankfully. They're staying home, they're doing self-care, right? They're taking care of their loved ones. I think that I've thoroughly enjoyed working remotely. However, I've been very intentional about still creating that connection in the organization I work for, even right now, who went remote before everyone else started doing that. It's enabled us to attract talent we wouldn't have otherwise. You know, we've been able to distribute our workforce across Canada, where we had, previously been in one city in Ontario. And I think that it's enabled us to provide an environment that still cultivates the needs of our team, where they can truly thrive and do the best work that they can. And I think we've also been able to attract talent that otherwise we wouldn't have, because some of those companies that they were working for were forcing folks back to the office and they weren't ready. Psychologically, maybe not ready. Mentally, you know, like I think a lot of people have, there's still a lot of fear there. Physically not ready, right? For a variety of reasons. Maybe maybe they're immune compromised, et cetera. And then just for their own health and wellness, they need to be looking for somewhere where they can work remotely. I agree with you. I don't think I'm a people person. I'm an extrovert. I need that connection. I do feel though that you can still get that connection if you're working with an organization that's being really intentional to curate that, to develop that. In person is amazing. No one's going to say no to that. I think though, I guess my question would be, if I was advising some of these companies as they're making these decisions, why are you making this call? You know, who do you think you're making this call for? And, are you leaning in and connecting in with your team? Are you being curious? Are you understanding the impact that this potential change of going back full time to the office is going to have on your workforce? And are you prepared about the potential changes that might lead to increased turnover for folks that aren't willing to give up that flexibility that they've experienced for almost 3 years? And again, I would go back to I'm more curious as to the why. Why is this so important to bring everyone back 5 days a week or 4 days a week? Why 4 day versus 3 days or 2 days? I just hope the organizations making these decisions are being really intentional and very thorough about the decision. And that, you know, back to our point about data, do they have the data they need, right, to truly make the best decision on behalf of their organization?
I think it's a fair question. And I think that the answer in a lot of cases is it's based on leaders' preferences. And let's be honest, it's easier to lead people when you're co-located. It just is. It's easier to follow up on work. It's easier to provide feedback. You can be more informal. Intentionality isn't as important. But in a world where you need to book some time in somebody's meeting, where in their calendar to have a conversation and be planful about the work that's being done, following up on the work, those kind of things can exist, but it's just more challenging. And for some leaders, they prefer a more informal approach. That alone isn't reason to impact your workforce that, to your point, may be experiencing second and third degree effects of having to catch the bus into the office or address childcare gaps or have elder care considerations at home. And I think the understanding is that if the lesser of two evils, to use a tired term, is if a leader needs to go through a personal transformation or a leadership transformation to be more in service to a workforce that's more dispersed, then that's the lesser of two evils versus having to ask hundreds, if not thousands, of people to accommodate their schedule to suit yours. And I get it when you've established yourself in the career, you have lots of success behind you, you have lots of evidence to point to the fact that the way you do things has worked. I appreciate that. And there needs to be recognition that conditions have shifted and that the world is different and that needs are different. And in a knowledge-based economy, we need everybody committed to our goals. And that becomes more challenging when you sort of take away liberties that have been given over the last 3 years, regardless of the concerns. I think, Heidi, as expected, this conversation's flown by. What's next for you? What's next on your radar as we go forward? What are you thinking about?
I think that it's an exciting time, in my own career. I think for a lot of us, again, sort of this opportunity to reimagine what's next for all of us and really taking the time to distill down what matters. I want to continue to be making an impact. I want to continue to be inspired. I want to continue to be growing. And I want to be growing in the role that I have and my volunteer work. I want to continue to be connecting with other people like you, where, you know, we continue to kind of learn from each other's lived experiences. I think that's why remote is so cool, because, you know, think about your network 3 years ago, Matt, and think about what it looks like today. My network has grown from a diversity perspective geographically, you know, different organizations. I mean, you know, all elements of diversity. And I think that that is because, you know, we had to be doing things a bit differently. I am a lifelong learner and I look for different opportunities to kind of, you know, learn and grow. And I think that, you know, again, I feel in some ways, although some people may look at me and go, I'm later in my career, I feel like I'm just getting started.
Thank you so much for joining today. It was always a good conversation to be had, and I'm looking forward to continuing this conversation as we move forward. So thank you again for your time, and let's keep in touch.
Thank you, Matt.
Bento HR is a digital transformation consultancy working at the intersection of strategy, technology, and people operations. We partner with organizations, private equity, and venture capital firms to accelerate value creation and identify the organization's highest leverage initiatives. And this can take place in many forms, from strategic planning and alignment to technology, procurement, implementation, and integration, along with organizational design, process reengineering, and change management. With our proven track record of working with complex, high-growth organizations, we provide a lens that goes beyond the balance sheet, increasing enterprise readiness, resilience, and value. For more information, check us out at bentohr.com.